This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 343, Walking to Mordor. Hello and welcome to GamesAtWork.biz. This is Andy Piper coming to you from my recording studio somewhere in southwest London. And I am joined to talk about games and work and all kinds of fun stuff by my good friend, Mr. Michael Martin. How's it going, Michael?
Fantastic, Andy. Great to be here. And I think we've got a really interesting set of show topics for today. We're going to miss our friend and co-host, Mr. Rowe, but I'm sure he will be likewise engaged, like the rest of our audience, too. Let's get things started with an interesting exercise application. And I want to give a shout out to the folks over at MIT and especially to Charlotte G, who has authored the download from MIT. And I've found a couple of interesting articles. One of them is from CNET talking about a Lord of the Rings app to encourage exercise. And we all know that one simply does not walk into Mordor. We know that. But if you wanted to know how far it was from from Bag End to Mordor, and you wanted to keep track of your journey along that way, like when you go out and walk in the evening or walk around your garden, as our friend Ian does, you could use this app to see how far you've gotten, right? Did you get to Tom Bombadil's house? Have you made it to the Prancing Pony? Are you, you know, somewhere in Gondor? And how long does it take you to get all the way to Mordor where you could drop off the ring and hitch a ride back with the eagles, which would have been a whole much faster way to go.
This is insane. I mean, you know, if you watch all of the extended edition of the movies, you know, you're going to be sat there for sort of, I think, something like 10 or 11 hours. You know, as this notes for this particular person, it would, based on their, I think it's, what was it, 10 miles a day, 10 miles a week.
Yeah.
That they do there in their walking, it's going to take approximately 3 years, 8 months and more to get to Mordor. It's just amazing that somebody thought of making this into an app. I mean, I love that this story begins with somebody having posted on TikTok the distance, and then that person going to the person who discovered this going to look for an app to help them figure this out and record it, and then they actually found the Walk to Mordor app. That's just amazing. I don't know if it's available on iOS. It's definitely available on iOS. I don't know if it's available on Android as well, but yeah, crazy.
Well, we'll find it. We'll make sure there are links out there for those of you who want to give this a go. But it sounds to me like you definitely want to be a committed Lord of the Rings fan to take advantage of something like this and see quite how far you've gotten.
I still have the Pokemon Go app recording getting access to my health data to see how many steps I've done. So when I very occasionally open the app, which is not very often anymore, particularly since we, you know, don't go outside so much, I do get some, you know, weekly bonuses if I open the app because it's been recording, you know, my footsteps, but or accessing my health data. But yeah, generally speaking, I'm not being that obsessive about it at the moment, other than just sort of trying to close my three rings in the activity app every day.
I've been taking off my Apple Watch more frequently these days when I'm going through my exercise routine, mostly because I don't want to hurt somebody else doing my martial arts wearing my Apple Watch, which is helping me track my ring closure and my exercise logging. But if I were to come across someone's body with the watch, I could wind up hurting them. So I've now lost that element that I've been having many streaks and so on for a while. And it's like, I'm like, okay, fine, living with it. Now, Now, Andy, we've got some other exercising the brain kind of things here, where you've been doing an awful lot with Raspberry Pi these days. And I've seen some of these articles coming across around Raspberry Pi plus Lego hooked together,
I know, right?
For all kinds of awesome fun. So tell us about it.
So on Tuesday, the Raspberry Pi company and foundation announced that they have a collaboration with Lego, so that they now have a hat. So hat means hardware attached on top. So it's like the little, it's like an Arduino shield, or it's like an interface board that plugs on top of the Raspberry Pi. They're called hats. There's a specification for them. So they've come up with one called the Build Hat, and the connectors on it connect directly to Lego motors, and Lego have their own connectors for these things. So the collaboration enables you to drive components from the Lego system, specifically the Lego Spike kit, which is an educational kit for sort of teaching robotics and things like that, similar to the Mindstorms kits. And you can plug those items into the Pi so that you take advantage of the sensors that you can add on a Pi, which could include things like a camera or anything really, and use it with your Lego. Now, there's a couple of interesting things. First of all, that it's a collaboration. So, you know, the hardware that goes on the Pi has the connectors for the Lego. On the Lego side, they've actually now, in the latest expansion kit for their system, have come up with a Lego Technic plate that will hold a single board computer like the Pi. It's the first time that a Lego piece has been made to connect with something other than something in the Lego system. So there's been some amazing stuff that's come out this week. Videos come out around the launch of this new expansion kit. It's intended for, you know, for educational purposes, but as usual, enthusiasts getting their hands on it. There's been some really fun ones involving people building sort of Lego pumpkins that recognize your friends, can respond to them using, you know, cameras and machine learning and all those kind of things. It's super fun. And you can program it all using a programming language called Python, which most of our listeners will be familiar with, if not all of them will have heard of it. It's very fun. Now, one of the negative threads has been, well, Lego's expensive already, and then you have to buy this specific sort of Lego kit to work with the Build Hat, and you have to buy the Build Hat, and then you have to have a Pi, and, you know, to build a robot, suddenly you're looking at hundreds of dollars, right? But there is that to it. But there are also other ways of using the kit, so that they don't, you know, require you to have all of the biggest and best options. And I just think it's great. I mean, both the Lego company and the Raspberry Pi Foundation have, you know, this commitment to teaching and also fun and play. So I just love the way that this has all come together. I think it's fantastic.
So I've not really studied much of this just yet, Andy, but you're exactly on the point that I'm most excited about here, too. When you think about how well Lego does to explain, and in non-language-specific ways, how to accomplish the build of a set with clarity, with purpose, make it easy, if you combine that plus a language like Python, which is also relatively easy to understand, and could be a very good first language for people to do, you're now having an ability to engage people where they're having fun, they're creating something that's meaningful, and they've got a build that actually works. And it's that sort of that moment when it works, you're like, yes, this is great. Now I can take it and I can morph it, and I can change it, and I can rebuild it, which is what Lego does so exceptionally well. And that's what programming is supposed to do, too. So I haven't seen yet the two together, like the Spike capabilities plus the education Lego education capabilities. Have you seen where it's gone very much in that direction already, or is that coming?
It has gone in that direction. I haven't played with Spike myself yet. I've played with the now I'm forgetting the name of the kit, but it was the sort of Boost, Lego Boost, which gives you sort of a scratch like environment, sort of drag and drop type environment on a connected tablet, and then you can drive your robot. I think the Boost kit also works with the Lego droids that you can get. So, I mean, Lego's built the core of a system that connects with the rest of the parts. With Spike, they've gone into sort of Technic parts, so you can build sort of more mechanical items than you can with a regular Lego system bricks. But yeah, they definitely take that approach of, you know, build and rebuild and think about what you're doing and learn the principles. The materials that Lego Education have are really, really strong. So yeah, I'm excited about this. I have absolutely no reason to have one of these kits, but anyway, I've certainly got plenty of Raspberry Pis around, as you say. I've been playing with one this week with Node Red, which some friends of ours produced for an Internet of Things wiring sort of graphical user interface, and taking sensor data from an air quality sensor and publishing it on MQTT. So I've been doing that with a Pi this week. So there's some fun things I've been playing with there. Doesn't involve Lego, but I'm sure I can get Lego involved before too long.
Just wait.
Right?
It's coming. Well, I'm really excited about this. My hope is that I will personally get a chance to kind of dive into this direction, and I might lean on you a bit, Andy, to get a recommendation about where to best start, you know, which best Pi model to go after, keep the costs relatively low to begin, and do a project or two that would be meaningful. So I'm real excited about this.
Yeah.
Now, if I wanted to do something completely different, like if I wanted to play Doom on something it wasn't intended to play Doom on, apparently here you found an article that allows you to use web browser checkboxes to play Doom. So,
I mean, I think listeners know that I've been obsessed with, well, I mean, Doom is one example of, you know, can it run X, right? And Doom is a classic one that gets ported to any kind of device quite often. This one I just loved, that they're using WebAssembly and basically using that as a graphics canvas. So using the browser and checkboxes as the graphics canvas for a WebAssembly-based game. So it's ridiculous. It's stupid. Nobody would reasonably do it, but that's why people are doing it. So yeah, it's play Doom in a browser using web checkboxes as the graphics. It's mad.
Too funny. So staying on that theme, which you imagine we might do on a podcast dealing with games and work and how they work with games, there was an article or an audio article today on National Public Radio that was talking about a beer game app. So let me do the setup for this a little bit, and then we'll kind of drink it all in, so to speak. The way this app works is that it simulates, it's a business simulator, and it's been around for quite a long time. I can't remember which university it was created in, but it was like the 1960s or 70s. And it was designed to do supply chain simulation so that you would have different players all trying to optimize their portion of the supply chain. So you would have a brewer, you'd have a distributor, you'd have a wholesaler.
Are you saying that they've been using games to teach business since the 1960s?
That's crazy, isn't it? And even before.
Like using games for work, that's just weird.
It's insane when you think about it. And I was reminded, actually, when I first heard this on the radio, when I was going through my MBA education, we played a very similar game that was dealing with global manufacturing, supply-demand planning, and logistics related to building refrigerators. And it was a cooperative, competitive kind of game where you'd be part of a company and you have to determine where do you want to build your factories. It takes time to build them. It takes time to manufacture. It takes time to get the refrigerators on a ship and to the target customers. And then there's all kinds of interesting supply chain shocks that happen, you know, like major tsunami hits this portion of the world and wipes out manufacturing capability. If you weren't there, no problem. If you were, yikes. So this game around beer, and there's many of these sort of simulations, was set up in such a way that you've got different roles, different players, and each turn of the game, kind of like diplomacy, is you're making a prediction. Like, hey, here's how much beer I want to order. I'm a wholesaler. I'm a distributor, right? And how much am I going to produce if I'm playing the role of the brewer? And the article talks about the supply chain bullwhip. So very small changes in end customer demand. You know, like I like IPAs and I want more IPAs, can all of a sudden hit that bullwhip demand all the way back on the producer because everybody is now trying to optimize what they anticipate their demand to be and what they do and what they produce.
Right.
So fun example of a real game and fun example of what really happens in a supply chain and the reactions where people get exasperated. They're like, fine. I don't care anymore. I'm going to produce a whole bunch and it might go into inventory or it might get wasted. And I don't care anymore because my pipeline is telling me I gotta have this. So I haven't found the game yet because this was done with paper and tokens and pencils or Lego bricks, who knows. But there's now an electronic equivalent of it that you can play yourself.
Beergameapp.com.
You found it already.
You can check that out on the web. There's also a board game. This is not the same game. This is a different game. But it's somewhat similar in the sense of, you know, process flow. And it's a pocket game. So it fits in a mint tin. It's called Microbrew. It's a little complex. I've played it. I own it. I've played it just a couple of times. But I think it's a 1-4 player. I beg your pardon. It's a 2-player game where you're competing to sort of make the best beers. So this one's got a lot more competitive and creative nature to it than just optimizing process. But there is still a process in terms of, this models the actual brewing of the hop, using the hops and brewing different flavors, which is quite fun. But I honestly do own it. I think it was a Kickstarter. It might have been. I haven't enjoyed it as much as I hoped because it's a little complex. And unless you learn it really well and it flows really easily, you kind of lose the fun. But yeah, no, the beer game that you were talking about, the supply chain one, sounds like an interesting way of sort of learning about supply chain management and process improvement and all those kind of fun things we do in business, folks.
You learn how to do them better. Why not? All right. So moving along, this probably has a link into the game kind of structure here too, is a website, a capability called Ask Delphi that is, according to its description, a computational model for descriptive ethics.
Yeah, you see, now I was surprised at the beginning, just before we started recording, you said you hadn't come across this. Quite a thing this week. It's certainly been talked about in my sort of network. And the original buzz behind it was that they allegedly were using Reddit as the source of a lot of the judgments. Now, if you look at the front page of this website, it now explains that they're not learning judgments from Reddit. They're using Reddit as a source of the moral questions because it's a good source of ethically questionable situations. Now, the idea of this is that it's an experimental AI that is intended to provide you some, well, it's not intended to provide, it says very specifically it should not be used for advice for humans and could be offensive or problematic, but it's a modeling AI which is meant to guess how an average American person might judge the ethics of a particular situation. So as I've loaded the page right now, it gives me a few example questions that I can click through to. So an example, ignoring a phone call if the phone call is urgent. So let's ask Delphi to ponder that. And Delphi speculates that is rude. Okay. Can I park in a handicapped spot if I don't have a disability? Let's see what it thinks for that one. It's wrong. Okay. Feeding your cat using forks. It's wrong, says Delphi. I also asked it earlier, should I listen to Games at Work.biz? What did it tell me? I'm trying to remember. That was in a different... I took a screenshot. I haven't typed it out right now. It said it's fine. It's fine.
Oh, it's fine. Okay.
It's right to listen to.
That's good.
Have you got an example, Michael, that you might want to...
Yeah, I did. I took an example. I said, should I put solar panels on my roof?
Uh-huh.
Right? And yep. The response coming back is, it's good. And given the meetings that are coming up soon in Scotland, be nice if more people did something like that.
Should you get involved in a land war in Asia?
Ooh, not if you're playing Risk.
You should not.
The answer would be no.
Well, that's also a classic line from The Princess Bride. Some of the interesting ones that came up earlier in the week that were discussed in my networks. Invading Canada is rude. Crushing your enemies, seeing them driven before you, and hearing the lamentations of their women—that's glorious.
Oh, glorious!
And with robbing a bank if it creates jobs is okay.
That's okay. I asked whether does one simply walk to Mordor, and it says one shouldn't.
So now the other interesting thing is the way that you phrase the questions or provide the situations for Delphi to ponder seems to me to affect the responses as well. I've just copied and pasted the crushing your enemies one. But let's put should I instead of just putting crushing your enemies. Should I crush my enemies? Crush my enemies. See them driven before me, and hear. I'm just rephrasing this and hear the lamentations of their women. So I'm now making this into a should I question. And it now says it still says it's glorious. Interestingly.
Oh.
I'm not quite sure. As often with these kind of things, I'm not quite sure how it's coming up with it all.
It's a little Magic 8-Ball-esque here, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It feels that way. But there are, there is a paper, there is a data set, there's an FAQ. Go read about it, go check it out if you're interested. It keeps a history of the speculations. It's a demo.
You can upvote or downvote too. I'm seeing
right. Well. Yeah, you can say whether you agree with it or not. You can say whether you're not morally sure, ethically sure about the judgment that's been made. So yeah, I thought that was a classic sort of Games at Work sort of Dog Ear Nation Games at Work sort of toy, a web toy that we could discuss.
So if it were to get smart enough. And then, I don't know, what you hook it into a series of legal decisions, could it create a for and a dissent, kind of structure about what's appropriate, legal, and ethically right? Maybe.
I have just asked, should I mix Raspberry Pi with Lego? And I've been told that I should not. So I'm going to say that I do not agree with that.
Oh, yes. Because that would be wrong. Not
do
to
I
do
have
that.
Feedback to improve the prediction? Yeah, I'm going to paste in one of our links from the show notes.
Absolutely. Go crawl that. Learn about it.
There you go. Here's the Raspberry Pi Founder, what the Raspberry Pi Foundation says. There you go. Stick that in your ethical moral judgment AI.
Well, something I find is completely wrong is ransomware. Okay. And there's been lots of this going on as of late, and plenty of news on various subjects. In fact, there was another one from the download at MIT that I didn't put into our playlist for today, dealing with companies that do ransomware are now recruiting for people to come work for them, which I think Delphi would hopefully say is ethically wrong. Should I go work for a ransomware company? I would hope they would say it's wrong. But I came across an article that made me a little upset, actually, in that there's a company called Ferrara, F-E-R-R-A-R-A. I think they're out of Chicago, if I remember right. Mm. And this company is the one that does all the Willy Wonka related stuff, Nerds,
okay.
and more. And they have atomic fireballs. Those were like a staple for me as a kid because they were like these cinnamony hot things, and then they would cool off, and then we'd get hot again. They cool off, and you could buy a whole box of them and sell them for 5 cents a piece and make money off of that too. Anyway. Not that
this
I
sounds like this
that,
sounds like really. It more about your childhood than it does about generally, you know, bad
well,
people.
Yeah, but if it's right before Halloween, they're having to deal with their supply demand, you know, situation. Right, they're probably playing the beer game. How many fireballs am I going to make? You know, do I have enough for Halloween? And this is not the time to go and hit them and extort them with a ransomware attack.
Is it okay to unleash ransomware on a candy company?
Yeah,
the answer ought to be that, no. Delphi, let's have a think about this. It says Delphi speculates that it's petty.
It is petty.
There you go.
Terrible timing. That'd be like a candy cane maker at Christmas.
I think from now on in the show, we should just every time ask we talk Delphi. About a topic, we should just ask Delphi, and that'll. That will instantly resolve any questions between the three of us.
Should we ask Delphi if it's okay for Spotify to break podcasts?
Let's talk about that instead. Why not? Let's actually have a conversation. What do you think about this? Did you see this story this week from Wired?
Only briefly. And my general idea is no, you shouldn't be breaking podcasts, right?
I mean, we're
speaking
a
as a podcaster.
Don't
I don't want to be broken.
Right.
We must break you. No, it should be something that is we're uplifted. We're producing content that's valuable for the world, right? Play games, learn about business, do stuff.
So the story is actually in Wired, but it references a series of articles by Matt Stoller, who's a director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project, basically talking about the state of podcasts being similar to the quote-unquote old web, sort of the web between 2000 and 2006, when everything was open. You know, there were a ton of standards like RSS. They would let you do sort of things like federation and syndication. You could finance your own websites through ads instead of there being some big ad platform that, you know, took a cut from everything and then controlled all the distribution. There weren't networks that were determining how often your stuff was seen so much. But because, you know, and then it goes on to talk about the fact how that changed on the web and then how it hasn't changed so much for podcasts, right? So at the end of the show, we often say, you know, in your favorite podcast app, you know, go find us, you know, go tell about, go write us a review on one of these places rather than, you know, like in this one place where it's the only place where you'll find us. So there's an argument that podcasts might, you know, Spotify in its drive to grow its share of the sort of audio market, Spotify might become a dominant player and limit or restrict the way that things are distributed. So I know I find it interesting. I think it's definitely an interesting comparison to the way the web's been in the past. I think one of the other interesting things was there was a reference in here to sort of the lack of innovation from was it in this story or another one? I was reading it, sort of a lack of innovation from companies like Apple on podcasts, although that, you know, arguably the iPod created podcasts, thus the name to some extent. you know, yes, it is here. Partly we don't have, you know, the dominant player, video, YouTube, for example, because Apple kind of passively innovated and just left it as a gap, and other people came along and built their own networks, like the Blueberry Podcast Network, for example, that helps independent people to build and distribute their stuff. You know, we don't have to be, you know, again, going back directly exclusive. To the story, Joe Rogan getting $100 million exclusive and one platform. We can distribute through lots, make money through none, in our case. unless you want to advertise on our podcast, which, you know, we would be happy to chat about. That sounds great.
Oh, we probably could come to an arrangement.
I mean, Michael needs to get some new HomePods minis. You know, he's only got the one color in his house right now. So, you know.
Well, yeah, both of mine are the same color, incidentally. So I actually do have the HomePod and a HomePod mini as well. So
I see. And you've got the classic HomePod. Yeah, you've got the legacy HomePod.
I do. And it's good. I really like it, you know. I have given it some thought about using it as a speakerphone here in the office, but since I do most of my calls and the like with headphones on, it really wouldn't do me a whole lot of good.
Should I keep my HomePod? Ponder. Oh,
ponder that.
Should I keep my HomePod? It's okay. It's okay, Michael. You can keep it.
All right, good. I was a little worried there that I would have to adhere to the response.
I'm generally interested in the podcast story with the Spotify piece. You know, I'm not sure what I think about Spotify specifically potentially breaking the model. I think that there's a bunch of pressures in the space, and I think generally in the online media space, I think there's pressures to, you know, to find distribution. And potentially find and get monetized potentially, if that's what you're in it for. Right. I'm curious what our listeners think. If they've got views, please do tweet at us, games@work_beers on Twitter, comment on our blog, or just, you know, get in touch, let us know what you think, and see if you've got any thoughts.
Yeah, love to hear that, because we've focused on not being exclusive. I can see where some are, and those are the models that shoot. You know, we just talked about this a few minutes ago in the beer game, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got a number of players. You can vertically or horizontally integrate and acquire, and that's some of what's happened here. We've seen that happen in like XM and Sirius Radio. Mm-hmm. We've seen it happen in book publishing. We've certainly seen it in video game publishing, where there's an exclusive title that is on PlayStation or Xbox or for a time or forever, right? So right. Those are ways to help drive who gets what and how long it stays there, and, you know, locking people into an environment that they want to be locked into, right? Or that they feel like they have to in order to get that particular content. So nothing really new in that way at all, in my mind. But it's the economics around it. You're right, Andy. And for those that are doing this for the economics and get $100 million, more power to them. If someone is interested for $100 million for us, I'm sure we could come to an arrangement.
I think we could talk about it. I'd be willing to get involved in that discussion for sure.
Yeah, at least sit down for a little while.
Right. What should we end on? We should end on something. What do you think? Something light, something fun? What do you think?
Something very light and very fun. Maybe another gaming environment that has some specific games on it, like Stadia.
So I, as listeners may know, I bought a Stadia controller, because that's what you needed to buy, just the controller, and everything's in the cloud and it all streams. So I am a Stadia, occasional Stadia user. Now, I will say, and I think I have said on the podcast, it has got a lot better, especially since, you know, you're now able to play as you are with Xbox cloud gaming through devices like the iPad, through the browser now, and things like that. But I don't use a Stadia very often. But now I might. Now I might. I saw a tweet just an hour or so ago, talking about the AAA titles coming to Stadia, Google Stadia, this Halloween, and the one that's just been announced is Peppa Pig, my friend Peppa Pig. So I think If you're not tempted by the latest Stadia offers with a Chromecast Ultra or whatever you get with it and a YouTube Premium subscription and whatever else they're kicking you back in there, buy it for Peppa Pig.
Peppa Pig. Peppa there Pig. You go.
Peppa Pig. And then send Peppa Pig to Mordor and see how they get on.
Do you think Delphi would approve?
Let's have a look. Let's just ask. Should I play my friend Peppa Pig on Google Stadia? Ponder. And we have the final answer. It's fine.
It's fine.
And on that bombshell, I think that's about the all we have time for on this week's show.
That's all we have time. Yep.
So, we
enjoyed having you. Thanks for listening. Come again in another week, and there'll be more stuff coming and more things from you as well. So
let us know what you think of our tremendously independent podcast on whatever platform you like.
Exactly. See you next time, everybody. Bye. See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.